Welcome to episode 11 of Idiom America, part 3 of idioms involving U.S. presidents. And we're starting out with my favorite president, the remarkable Abraham Lincoln. And you've probably seen some version of that meme on the internet that has a picture of Abraham Lincoln alongside a quote that is attributed to him that goes something like, "Don't believe everything you read on the internet just because there is a picture with a quote next to it. Abraham Lincoln." Or, "The problem with quotes found on the internet is that they are often not true. Abraham Lincoln." And indeed, Lincoln probably gets more quotes falsely attributed to him than just about anybody. And for good reason, because the man was wise. And one of those that gets attributed to him, but that I can't identify a source for, is, "If I were two-faced, would I be wearing this one?" It sounds like something Honest Abe would say, since in addition to having a reputation for speaking the truth, he also had a good sense of humor, and he was known to poke fun of himself and his appearance. And that idiom, two-faced, meaning deceitful, insincere, dishonest, has been around since at least the 16th century, if not before. And it comes from the Roman god Janus, who is the god of doorways and gateways. And as those doorways, gateways can be passed in either direction, he came to represent the past and the future. And his image was of a man with two faces. As an aside, he was also the god of January, which is where that name comes from. But you can see images of Janus on old Roman coins, for example. And once you have that image of a two-faced man, it seems pretty natural to start to apply that term to somebody who's a hypocrite by saying one thing to one person and a conflicting thing to someone else. And there's also an expression I hadn't heard of before looking into the origin of this one, and that's Janus-faced. It means basically the same thing as two-faced, but it also has a specialty meaning where you can call something a Janus-faced word. And that refers to something called a contronym. And a contronym is when a word can mean both one thing and that thing's opposite. So for example, you have to dust, which can mean to remove dust, as in taking a feather duster and doing some cleaning. But it can also mean to sprinkle with soil or dust, as in dusting some German pancakes with powdered sugar before adding a squeeze of lime or lemon. Some more examples of contronyms are to rent, which can mean to sell one's apartment for temporary use by another, but it can also mean to buy someone's apartment from another for temporary use. To sanction is another one, which can mean to condone or grant approval, but also to condemn or penalize. And I could go on all day with these contronyms, as there are a lot of them out there, and it's kind of fun just to Google them or to try to come up with your own. But moving on. Another thing the internet claims that Lincoln said is, "Those who write clearly have readers. Those who write obscurely have commentators." Turns out that, though, that this wasn't actually Lincoln. It was Albert Camus. And there are some who even refer to this as Camus' Law. But again, this could have been Lincoln, as it fits his rhetorical style, which was direct and clear. And there's a famous incident that illustrates this that involved the use of the term sugarcoating. During the July following his inauguration, Lincoln was trying to print out a message to send to Congress that opposed the secession threatened by Southerners. And the message said in part, "With rebellion thus sugarcoated, they have been drugging the public mind of their section for more than 30 years, until at length they have brought many good men to a willingness to take up arms against the government." A guy named John D. DeFries, who was the government printer, was disturbed by the use of the term sugarcoated. And so, being on good terms with Lincoln, he went to him and he told him that a message to Congress was a different affair from a speech at a mass meeting in Illinois, that the message would become part of history, and so should be written with that in mind, and that the use of the term sugarcoated was undignified. And Lincoln is reported to have replied, "DeFries, that word expresses precisely my idea, and I am not going to change it. The time will never come in this country when the people won't know exactly what sugarcoated means." Truth. Lincoln's use of that kind of language, combined with the fact that he's rightly regarded for rhetoric that had immense power, suggests that there should be a few idioms or neologisms out there that would be attributable to Lincoln, but it turns out that the only one I can find is the term Michigander, which, along with Michiganian, is a demonym used to refer to somebody from Michigan. And this term comes from 1948, when Lincoln referred to Senator Lewis Cass from Michigan as the Great Michigander. And Cass, if you'll recall, made an appearance in the last episode when he was the leading candidate for president, who was beat out by the dark horse candidate Franklin Pierce. At any rate, Lincoln was poking fun here at Cass because he was said in the press to resemble a goose. And so Michigander was playing off that, combining Michigan with Gander. But other than that, Lincoln's rhetorical might didn't come from linguistic innovation, but rather from the use of pre-existing words to communicate his ideas forcefully. And he's remembered for phrases like 47 years ago, and the mystic chords of memory, the better angels of our nature, and with malice toward none. And perhaps one of the most famous phrases he's remembered for is his metaphor for the Civil War of a house divided. And this came from when he told the Republican State Convention in 1858 that a house divided against itself cannot stand. But Lincoln didn't come up with this image. Rather, its power comes partly from the fact that it echoes an older source, the Bible, where in the Gospel of Mark it reads, "And if the house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand." From Lincoln, who's widely regarded as the best president, the country whipsawed to Andrew Johnson, widely regarded as one of the worst, if not the worst, president, and the first one to be impeached, although the Senate didn't convict. Just one vote shy there. This is a guy who opposed the 14th Amendment, which gave citizenship to former slaves, which was kind of one of the whole points of the Civil War. He also opposed a Freedmen's Bureau and various civil rights bills as unconstitutional. As Johnson put it, "I am sworn to uphold the Constitution as Andy Johnson understands it and interprets it." Andy Johnson. This practice of referring to oneself in the third person is called illeism, I-L-L-E-I-S-M. And it can be done for different reasons, such as for self-promotion. Bob Dole comes to mind as somebody who did that a lot. It can be used by celebrities to distance their public persona from their actual self, something Marilyn Monroe used to do. Anyway, that's probably enough said about Andy Johnson, who seemed to be pretty rigid and unimaginative in his thinking and an unlikely source for colorful idiom. This is the guy who undertook a big speaking tour to try to garner support for his policies, and he branded that tour with the name Swing Around the Circle. And unmemorably, the name derives from the fact that the tour kind of followed a circle from D.C. to New York to Chicago to St. Louis and back again. And the speaking tour was a widely panned disaster. And in another bit of illyism, there's a political cartoon from the time that covers the tour, and it depicts Andy Johnson with a saint or martyr's halo and uttering the quote, "Who has suffered more for you in this union than Andrew Johnson?" And the cartoon goes on to include images of suffering wives and children, soldiers and sailors, and note that Andy must have forgotten about all these. And I can't tell if Johnson actually said this or not, but regardless, it gives a flavor for how his speechifying was perceived by the public. Now we come to number 18, Ulysses S. Grant. And Grant was a pretty effective president. He created the first Civil Service Commission, created the Justice Department, enforced civil rights for African Americans during Reconstruction, nominated some African Americans to prominent federal offices, and crushed the Ku Klux Klan. He was also known as a heavy drinker. There's the anecdote about how some war managers were once complaining to Lincoln about Grant's drunkenness when Grant was his general, and Lincoln responded, "You surprise me, gentlemen. But, I say, can you tell me where he gets his whiskey?" "We cannot, Mr. President, but why do you desire to know?" "Because if I can only find out, I will send a barrel to every general in the army." And apparently Grant liked to smoke tobacco as well, as he once quipped, "Cheap cigars come in handy. They stifle the odor of cheap politicians." And that idiom, "come in handy," meaning to be useful or convenient in a particular situation, seems to have started to take off right around the time Grant became the 18th president in 1869. And it's just steadily increased in usage from there. The word "handy" needs no explanation. It's long been used to mean useful or convenient. But adding the "come in" part is where the idiom comes in, I think. And it means about the same, honestly. Perhaps it gives the phrase a little bit of a meaning that the thing that comes in handy is recognized to be useful in general, but perhaps not yet for a specific purpose, so it will be useful only later on. But other than this possible slight distinction, the comes in part seems to be largely redundant. That just gets added on for some reason. Is there any difference between comes in handy and handy? What about a guy who comes in last in a race versus a guy who was just last? Anyway, coming in at number 19 is Rutherford B. Hayes, elected in 1876. And Rutherford is a name you don't hear much anymore. I looked it up in the Social Security Administration's website, but it only has the popularity of names going back to 1900, and then only if it appears in the top 1,000. And Rutherford came in at number 910 in the year 1905 for some reason, but that's about it. If it had been a few years later, I'd say that had something to do with the physicist Ernest Rutherford, known as the father of nuclear physics, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1908. But it seems unlikely that Rutherford's prior work on radiation led to some people naming their babies after him, but who knows? At any rate, Rutherford B. Hayes seems to have been a pretty decent president, middle of the pack. He's a rarity, and he said he would only run for one term, and he meant it, although it's likely he would have been reelected. And I couldn't really find any idioms associated with Hayes, but he did speak out against wealth equality with some force, and he wasn't a big fan of corporations or the corporate form. And here's a representative quote from him. "The real difficulty is with the vast wealth and power in the hands of the few and the unscrupulous who represent or control capital. Hundreds of laws of Congress and the state legislatures are in the interests of these men and against the interests of working men. These need to be exposed and repealed. All laws on corporation, on taxation, on trusts, wills, descent, and the like need examination and extensive change. This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people no longer. It is a government of corporations, by corporations, and for corporations." And you can find people still saying the same thing today. So I thought it'd be worth taking a look at the origins of that word, corporation, which is an idiom of sorts in its own way, as it takes a familiar word for body, the Latin word corpus, think here our English word corpse, and then it takes that to stretch the word for forming in a body to apply it to something that's kind of the opposite of a physical body in some ways, to an abstract entity. No, although there's some that would disagree with that last part, though, I guess, as I think of Mitt Romney's famous remark in his 2012 run for president, that corporations are people too, my friend. But the corporate form has been around since the Roman times, as Roman law recognized a range of corporate entities under the names universitas, corpus, or collegium. And obviously, analogs there in universities, corporations, and colleges are seen today in America. And corporations get turbocharged in the 17th century when colonial ventures led to corporations like the Dutch East India Company or the Hudson's Bay Company. In America, although corporations had been around since the beginning, they started to really take off around the time of Hayes and continued into the early 20th century in a period known as the Gilded Age, you know, the time of railroads and electricity and oil and rapid industrialization and robber barons and Rockefellers and Carnegies. To take just one striking example, in 1870, the U.S. produced just 68,000 tons of steel. 20 years later, by 1890, it was producing 4.2 million tons. That's a remarkable increase. So Hayes, as president from 1877 to 1881, was in the thick of it, to say the least. James Garfield took over from Hayes at number 20, but he lasted only 4 months before he was assassinated by a guy named Charles Guiteau. And Guiteau was actually a Garfield supporter, and he'd put some effort into getting him elected. And he deemed his contribution to Garfield's victory sufficient to earn him the position of consul in Paris, or at least some sort of higher-up federal office, and he was disappointed when he didn't get it, blaming it on the Republican Party's dislike of a faction of the party known as stalwarts. And it's a pity, because Garfield seems like he would have made a good president, as backed up by his solid political career pre-presidency. James Garfield, he was the only U.S. president to come up with a novel proof for a mathematical theorem, The guy was genuinely interested in math, and he continued to study it even after he was elected to the House of Representatives. And so one day he was sitting around discussing mathematics with his fellow members of the House in his spare time, as congresspeople are famously wont to do. And he came up with a simple and unique proof to the Pythagorean theorem, which, as you might recall from your school days, is that old one about how the squares of the two sides of a right triangle, when added together, yield the square of the hypotenuse, you know, that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Anyway, I won't get into a solution, but you can Google it if you're interested. It's a pretty simple, elegant one. And that makes me think of that idiom, do the math, or you do the math, or you do the math. meaning to analyze the situation and come to a conclusion. And this idiom usually suggests that the answer is obvious, and it often suggests that no examination of the facts is even needed to come to such a logical conclusion. And I'm pretty sure that even though Garfield did do the math, literally, that he never used this expression in the idiomatic sense, as it appears to have arisen in the 1980s, believe it or not. But when you take a look at the phrase graphed in Google's Ingram, it really doesn't show up until then. And even then, in the 1980s, it appears to be used mainly in the literal sense, with lots of references in a technical context, actually running the numbers, doing the calculations, and, you know, doing the math, arriving at the result. It isn't until the 1990s that its usage starts to really take off as an idiom. And tracking down the precise origin of this one is difficult, however, and it's probably one of those that doesn't really have a precise origin. Rather, as it came to be used literally more and more often, some started to use it more and more often in the figurative sense, just stretching it, without any one origin that started the ball rolling. There are more idioms that come from math, as you might expect, although I think there's less than you might expect, and I won't get into them in any depth in this episode, but there are a lot of ones about counting, how something doesn't count or counts for something, for example. And a few more I come up with are something doesn't add up, or the lowest common denominator, as in appealing to that lowest level of taste, something base or vulgar. And there's also to go off on a tangent or to digress. And I feel like that's kind of what I'm starting to do when I should be talking about presidential idioms. So I'm going to nip these math idioms in the bud and end the episode there. Thanks for listening.